Sometimes the things we don't understand can scare us, leading to doubt, deflection onto others, the creation of assumptions, or excuses. In the case of Chris Tuff, when it comes to understanding millennials, changing the narrative provides new insight to a generation that many are still trying to figure out.
So one of my favorite quotes around the book itself is, millennials aren't the problem, they just expose the problem. My friend Evan LaPointe brought that up when I was meeting him for coffee. I was like, yep, there it is. Or when I met Mike Hibison, who's an executive at Home Depot, and one of the stories in my book, he turned to me, he goes, and he kind of whispered as he was meeting me for breakfast, he goes, Chris, I'm kind of like a millennial. You know what I'm figuring out after reading your book is millennials much more of a mindset than anything else. Like, exactly. And so if you look at all those misconceptions, some are true, you know, like needy. I think we're all a lot needier, you know, and I think we live in a world where we have instant validation, instant gratification, and instant everything. And the harsh reality is real success, true happiness, all of those great things in life come with hard work.
Also on this week's episode, we discuss the human need for connection, defining your metric of success, and how to attract the next generation of talent. And now, episode 15 of Culturation.
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
Are you ready? The main event of the evening.
The ideas.
It's the word that you put in.
The ability.
Can you dig it?
The talent.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
Those who influence, the entertainer, the business leader, and the entrepreneur, they're all right here on Culturation. And now, your host, Justin Epstein.
Welcome to Culturation. I'm your host, Justin Epstein. On this week's episode, we speak with the millennial whisperer, Chris Tuff. Chris became the youngest partner in the 100-year history of Atlanta-based advertising agency, 22 Squared, where he turned a team of millennials from an investment to a major profit center in short order. He is the author of USA Today bestseller, The Millennial Whisperer, a practical profit-driven playbook for leaders to better understand the world's largest generation. Having started his career as one of the first marketers to focus on helping startups work with Fortune 100 brands, including Facebook in 2005, Chris is obsessed with emerging trends in marketing. As EVP and Director of Content Marketing and Partnerships at 22 Squared, he helps push to get their existing clients access to first-to-market ad products and offerings. He's responsible for partnership development with tech and media companies like Twitter, Google, and Facebook. A sought-after leader in the digital marketing space, Chris has been featured on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, Fast Company, The New York Times, Wired, Bloomberg, Business Insider, Digiday, Social Times, Social Fresh, and consistently in advertising trade publications like Ad Age and Advertising Weekly. Chris has worked with individuals and departments at several Fortune 500 companies to help them improve recruiting and performance of millennial workers. When Chris isn't working, he kiteboards, mountain bikes, runs, and spends quality time with his wife and two daughters. With that being said, I would like to welcome my good friend, Chris Tuff, to the show. Chris, thanks for coming on today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So for those people that may not know you, kind of your background, I mean, that don't realize that we're talking to a national best-selling author, digital guru, agency specialist, I guess kind of give people a little context of who you are.
Yeah, I mean, I guess... I think, you know, one of my big things recently has been this idea that life should be a ruthless pursuit of passions. And there's no better example of that than my own journey. And that started with people are like, oh, so Chris, how did you end up in the digital media space? And I tell them about how after I graduated from Vanderbilt, I went up to Boston and I had 64 job interviews in Boston over a 8-month period. And I remember after the 64, for whatever reason, that was my breaking point.
Okay.
And my parents were like, okay, Chris, it's time to maybe get back to Atlanta where you have a better network. And it was my 65th, lucky 65, that I ended up having an interview at a place called Moxie Interactive. And, you know, there were under 20 people at that point. And in that interview, I actually felt my kind of passions for creativity and people and communications kind of come alive. And I think that helped get my first real job.
Okay.
And, you know, I think that process of the failed 64 job interviews was so critical to actually tapping into and seeing what was available. I mean, I could have been a stockbroker. You know, I was talking to Bear Stearns, whatever the big one that went down was.
Yeah, Bear Stearns.
Bear Stearns, yeah. But, you know, it's like, so my journey, I fell into the digital space. I started as an account executive, as you can imagine, especially as I've evolved and the ADD creative side of me did not do all that well as an account executive, but I did do that for 2 years, and then I was a copywriter, and then I was in media, and so I made a lot of these lateral moves, and my dad, I could just see, was like pulling out his hair, looking over at his son that just kept being paid $28,000 a year for 5 or 6 years in a row. But it's like this idea of this ruthless pursuit of passions and some of the things that I feel like we need to provide both our children, but also within our corporations, is just the ability for people to pursue, to make the moves over to what is closer to their head and heart. And then also to allow them to do that every few years, because our passions evolve. So it wasn't really until 2006 that I found my absolute passion, which was right as Facebook and social was coming about. And I was told by Chris Pinto and Joel Lunenfeld, they turned to me and they said, all right, Chris, you've had every single position at this company. Meanwhile, they're growing tremendously. I mean, that, you know, we went from 20 employees to 400 pretty quickly. And they said, all right, so there's this new thing. There's this viral video thing that's happening. I was like, what's a viral video? They're like, when people watch a lot of videos, watch a lot of streams of a video. And it was before YouTube. And they said, if you can get a video, if you can create your own viral video, we'll give you your own trend spotting department. And I was like, all right, done. So meanwhile, I was about to get engaged to my wife, Julie. We're both identical twins. And I was like, all right, well, if nothing else, I'll film this thing, my engagement, so our identical twins can feel a part of the experience. So I called one of my buddies who's a cameraman for The Real World, and we had a hidden camcorder, and we recorded this run of me going down Valley Road in Atlanta, and I had these hidden cameras, and I pretended to sprain my ankle, and I went from spraining my ankle to popping the question. And then I put it on ChristopherTuff.com, and it was 6 days later that the web hosting company called me, and they're like, Mr. Tuff, we want to let you know that you're getting 100,000 views every hour, and it's doubling on the hour. What do you want us to do? Because this is a lot of money. And I was like, let her rip. And Good Morning America flew down, and like, it turned into this ridiculous thing where it's like, oh my gosh, this is what happens when your passions collide with your career. And, you know, from then on out, I kind of fell into that digital space, and the rest was a little bit history.
So, as you can tell, most people after 5 job interviews, right, would be like, I'm done. Yeah. But 64 later, I don't even think I've spoken to 64 companies in my life, probably. You know, you don't just develop that overnight, that kind of grit, the hustle, and kind of not being discouraged, which I think is probably one of the biggest things we see with a lot of kids.
Yeah.
So I always try to go back and understand where people came from.
Yeah.
And there was something instilled in you from a certain age. So kind of childhood is where I like to start, because that also shows where we were raised, why we have this work ethic, why your brain works this way. What was your childhood look like? Where were you born?
Yeah.
Kind of stuff like that.
So I'm youngest of 6 kids.
Of 6?
6.
Boys, yeah. Girls, what's the ratio?
5 boys, 1 girl.
Wow.
I was always the, you know, we worked on seniority as with 6 kids. I mean, it was who the guy that was shotgun was my oldest brother, and then it kind of worked sequentially back. So I was in like the way, way back of the suburban in the corner being kicked, and you know, also an identical twin. And I tell people that I was a double mistake, right? Like, I mean, not only was I a, you know, the last of the crew, but I was the second one to come out of as an identical twin. So I really wasn't meant to be in this world. And, you know, a massively overachieving family, you know, the Ivy League schools all the way through and boarding schools, you know, grew up in the Northeast and, you know, very competitive. But, you know, I think it was through that. I remember just like sitting at the dinner table as a, you know, 6-7 year old, and I was just vying for attention. Like, I was doing anything possible to try to get I think both the validation with my family and my older siblings, as well as my parents. And it was hard, you know, I mean, my dad kids that I think he went to like 20 different emergency rooms because we would all get hurt so much because it was absolute chaos. And people will ask me, they're like, Chris, I can't, like, how did your parents parent with six kids? I'm like, they didn't parent. It was chaos. You know, like, it's not like it is today, like, yeah, with the high pressure stuff. So, you know, and I think my parents never gave it's not like they put this amount of pressure on me. I always put a massive amount of pressure on myself.
Do you think that was from seeing everybody kind of competitively, or was this, like you said, not getting certain attention? You're like, okay, I'm going to show them, and this is going to be kind of my driver in life.
Both of those things. And I think that's where the tenacity and grit would come. I mean, I think those are probably my two greatest strengths, but I'm also impatient as hell, right?
But that's why you get shit done.
Right. And I think it's also, it's one thing saying, it's another thing doing, you know? And like, you know, after there's probably nothing more difficult than publishing a book that is your heart and hustling to make it, which we'll talk about at some point. But, you know, that's been the most, the 64 job interviews. That's nothing compared to writing a book. And, but, you know, I think it goes back to like what's made me the way I am. I think it's both being the youngest six kids, but also an identical twin. So you've got someone that's exactly like you,
yeah,
you know, and I'm married to an identical twin. So we can talk a lot about, my wife and I talk a lot, and she was a competitive, she was a pro soccer player. And what I think being an identical twin, you've got someone that looks exactly like you, so you're always looking to beat them. So I think that also probably is a driver.
So now your identical twin and you, how similar, how different?
So, you know, there's two things to that. One, we're so different.
Yeah.
And we started that journey as soon as he went up north to college. I stayed south in Nashville and went to college. And, you know, I think it was at that point that we really started becoming our own people. I actually tried to change my name when I went to school to Topher. It didn't stick.
Didn't stick.
I was like, yeah, you know, I'm whole new identity. I'm going to be Topher from now on. And, but you know, I look at my wife and her twin sister, and they played soccer all the way through, and they didn't really create their own lives until their late 20s. But one thing that we talk about is now we have our foils, and you can see just how much your spouse molds you.
Yeah.
For the good, for the bad, you know, for all, like, you become, whether you want to or not, you become a lot of that pair piece. So I think that's one thing we've learned.
And then as kids, specifically yourself, what was kind of like your interest at that point? Was it sports? Was it music? Was it learning? What was kind of your thing that you were starting to carve out as your separator?
Good question. So I think it was anytime vying for attention. I actually grew up doing commercials with my twin brother.
Okay.
So we were on a lot of national commercials, Campbell Soup, Aunt Jemima, Yellow Pages, Kodak. Then, you know, I think that was a little bit of like our taste of, or at least my taste of, okay, being in the spotlight a little bit. That continued. I actually tried out for the real world in college and made it to the finals, and they sent out like at Vanderbilt, they sent out a whole like crew, and something in there kind of stuck along the way. But I would say that it was always kind of like that vying for the attention.
Yeah.
But also that constantly seeking outside validation from others, which I still work on today. And then, you know, sports to a certain extent. But I moved down to Atlanta in seventh grade, and I tried out, you know, in Boston, we're used to being so good at all that, you know, we were on the all-star team for baseball, we played tennis, and I was like, I got this, you know. I went and started trying out for the different sports teams in Atlanta, and I didn't make any of the teams. And I was like, I am the worst player in every single one of these sports. So I was like, screw it. I'm going to start the lacrosse team at my high school. And I was like, at least that I will be good at, because no one plays lacrosse. And now it's actually huge in Atlanta. Yeah. But yeah, that was kind of.
So what season of Real World, by the way, did you try out for?
11, Chicago.
Chicago.
Yeah, it was between me and the guy from Princeton, I guess.
And you lost to him?
Yeah, I lost to him.
Or did you make the right decision?
I lost to him, and thank God that happened. Otherwise, my wife would have never married me.
So, you know, it sounds like pretty active childhood, you know, everything from entertainment, you touched sports, you kind of had a pretty well-rounded childhood, it sounds like, and constantly looking to kind of thrive, stand out, and kind of be your own person. Yep. Do you think when, you know, most people, I feel, as kids, we're all trying to identify ourselves, mm-hmm. and we're trying to create our own kind of identity. Do you feel like you have to do it even more when you have a twin?
Yes.
Okay.
100%. But then you're also, because it's Chris, Ben, Chris.
Yeah.
It's like you're this one. You know, I wrote my college entrance, whatever, essay on the struggles of being an identical twin. And we were always lumped together. And it was so frustrating.
Yeah, now that makes sense.
So, yeah, it'll drive you crazy.
So now you end up going through all these things. Thankfully, the real world didn't work out.
Yeah.
Otherwise, who would have known? You could have been on, like, the Challenge 47.
Yeah.
How did you elect, or what made you decide the decision to go to Vanderbilt?
Well, I said to my parents that I was looking for one thing in my college kind of tour, and it was, I want to see people playing Frisbee and studying in the same domain. And, you know, when you're walking past the field and you got people studying, and I wanted that to be the perfect reflection of work-life balance and a social life, coupled with really good academics. And I went up there. I had no real intention. I'd toured like something like 20 schools in the Northeast, and then Vanderbilt was one of the few in the South that I looked at. And after leaving, I was like, yep, this is it. This is definitely it. And I also saw it as a time in my life that I could actually be different than my siblings.
Yeah.
And that was my first real step at doing something different and not following in the footsteps of the rest of my crew.
So when you made the decision to go to Vanderbilt, and like you said, kind of step out from the family, be a little different,
yeah.
Was it refreshing? Was it exciting? Was it scary? Was it everything?
Yeah, I mean, it was all of those things, and it's also why I changed my name to Topher, but then no one called me Topher. So, but no, it was all of those things, and I think it provided me that first affirmation that, Chris, not only can you do stuff on your own, but you can be your own dude, you know, and still excel at that.
So now when you went to Vanderbilt, what did you study there?
Human and organizational development, which is perfect, which is basically applied human psychology. And I would actually say I use that major more now than I did probably for my first few years. But it was such a perfect major for me because I love people.
So that's kind of what made you gravitate towards that, was the people interaction, things like that?
Yeah, and applied psychology.
You know, it's interesting that, first off, it's such a young age in college that you selected that.
I know.
But when you think about it, we all know businesses, life, relationships are all built on people, understanding people.
Totally.
So it's kind of interesting how it's come full circle for you.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I picked it because it was the easiest. I mean, let's be honest. I was at Vanderbilt and I was like, I mean, I'm going to steal some bases here. And I picked it because I liked it, but it was also the one of the easiest ones. I mean, and it was funny. I was telling someone the other day, I went abroad to London with NYU, and I tell people how my, you know, one of our buddies and roommates in the same kind of like dorm place was Aziz Ansari. And I always use Aziz with my teams as the example of like the greatest tenacity of anyone that I've ever met, because I was at his first five startup stand-up things. And but it was at that NYU, and I probably should admit to this, but I had four different classes in London, and I used the same thesis for all four classes. I found like the common thread that bound all four of them together. And I was telling my buddy Cody that the other day, and I was like, that's kind of like my life, you know, like now I'm trying to find these common themes of all these different people and things. And he turned to me, he goes, you know, that is a specialty. Like that, what you have, your ability to do that is unbelievable. But
yeah,
I digress a bit.
So Vanderbilt, you graduate. You know, most parents, I'm sure, the question is, well, you're getting your degree in this. What do you plan on doing? What was kind of your thought? What was next step after you graduated? Where are you going to now?
It was 2003, so it was just get a job.
Yeah.
You know, and that the job market was not great because they were, we were still kind of coming back from the dot-com bust, and it was difficult. And so for me, it was just get a job, which I did not do a great job of because it took 65 attempts.
So let me ask you a question. You're going through these job interviews. Are you not getting them? Are you not liking them? Is it a combination? Like, what is the reasoning that you're thinking that these are not coming to fruition?
I'm just not getting them. But I think also I'd go in there and I was just like this little shit, and I would, my passion wouldn't come through. And I think that was them being like, all right, well, this, I don't know if this person really, if this guy really wants it or not. And, you know, thank goodness it didn't. And I use that as an example. You know, my dad was a very successful, you know, executive. And one of the best things he ever did for me was nothing. And I tell people that I think one of the things that we do is, now I'm a parent, and what I hope to not do for my children is set up these job interviews that basically sets them in this track that isn't necessarily along their lines of passion and because of convenience.
Yeah.
And so those, the reason I didn't get those, I think it was that people were able to see through it. And Moxie saw me come in and I was all fired up because I was actually excited for the first time.
I mean, I think it's good though. You know, a lot of people just settle. And I don't think it's just job interviews. I think in life in general.
100%.
Because it's easy. It's comfortable. It's, I don't want to put in more work. I don't want to put in more time. So it sounds like your drive and fire isn't something that just all of a sudden came out of nowhere or developed. It seemed like since childhood, this was instilled in you that you were never going to kind of blend in or be part of the crowd.
Absolutely.
So now you make the jump to Moxie.
Yeah.
Number lucky 65.
Yeah.
It goes well. You know, you start with them as an AE
and
then kind of grow into these different roles, eventually into this trend spotter role and forecasting, which, by the way, first time I've ever even heard that title or division created.
Yeah.
I actually really like it, by the way.
Yeah.
So you end up creating this viral video.
Yeah.
Which, what year is this?
2006.
So we're not even in this discussion of what viral is. I mean, you're definitely on the brink of kind of breaking this and do a pretty successful job the first time, which most people will never replicate in their life.
Yeah.
So what kind of happens now that you're in this role and you're creating this new division? And by the way, at a young age too.
Yeah. Well, it crescendoed when I ended up branding my wedding, because my wife and I are both identical twins, Double Mint Wedding. And I was like, all right, well, I'm going to build a website for it, doublemintwedding.com. And I sent out like big Double Mint pieces of gum, and instead of Double Mint, it said Julie and Chris on it. And then it had all the details in the middle. And the Wall Street Journal got wind of this. And I guess it was a really slow day. And I woke up to my dad calling me, and he, with his British accent, he goes, Christopher, I always knew one of my sons would be on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. I just did not think it would be you. And there we were, my wife and I, Julie, with our pinprick pictures on the front page of the Wall Street Journal for my wedding website. And that was really where things crescendoed, where I knew I think I was onto something different. But then also that it's this idea of, you know, like when you're walking the talk, when life and work kind of just blur because you're that passionate about it. And so within Moxie, we had built kind of the trend spotting department. But after a year and a bit of that, I started to get a little distracted.
Got the itch.
I got the itch. And, you know, our current CEO, Richard Ward, says, Chris, you're like a shark. And if you stop swimming, you just die. So you got to recreate yourself every 2 years. And then it was then that actually we met, Justin.
Yeah.
I had this startup, Sneaky Sunday, which was a startup that was a little ahead of its time, a little bit of a city search with an insider's point of view as to where to go out, and where to stay, and where to eat in any given town.
So the question I have, it's rather interesting, and I didn't realize this till kind of now. You kind of have a history here, or a kind of pattern, to where you're breaking into things or doing things before they're actually hitting.
100%.
So first with the viral video, now with Sneaky Sunday, which was honestly ahead of its time.
Yes.
And but what is giving you, is there such clarity? Are you seeing these things clearly, or are they just flukes? Like, how did you start seeing this, and how does it come to you?
I see everything almost 2 years. And I have a friend, Chris Gummersall, you also know. He's even more exaggerated than I am. I see things usually about 2 years ahead, and he sees things like 4 years ahead. But we were talking about that, and it just, I instinctually gravitate towards it, and I become obsessed with it, and then it becomes my life. And, you know, I'm now doing that now with my book and this whole movement towards bringing more love and connection into our world. Like everything I do, whether it be as a parent, husband, or with the book itself at our organizations, how do we bring more love, empathy, and more real human to human connection? I'd say I'm ahead of my time on that, you know, but we're starting to see it, you know. And I think as a society, we and even in organizations, we go all the way left, then we go all the way right, then we go all the way left, we go all the way right. And for whatever reason, I usually just see that ahead of time, and then I become obsessed with it.
Is it also because, you know, you said you start feeling it? Do you think that not enough people listen to their gut and follow through? It sounds like once you get an inclination or anything in a particular space, you go with it and you go full steam ahead. Do you think people make excuses, or this can't be right, or what I'm feeling is probably not accurate? You know, what do you think people do in that department? Because there's so many times that you feel or you hear about people like, oh, I had that idea. Well, that's great that you had that idea, but did you execute it?
Yeah.
And I feel like they talk themselves out of it. Yeah. While you, on the other hand, use it as fuel and say, okay, if I'm feeling this and this is where I think it's going, I'm putting everything into it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, Sneaky Sunday, it was a failed startup because it was ahead of its time. And then we also had 2008 hit and 2009 in the recession. But with any of these things, there's a reason why our elders are called, for generations and generations, why we respect our elders is because they're wiser than us. And it's because they're wiser because they've had more experience. And I think people tend to forget that. And it's also where, when I start talking about millennials and why they've gotten such a bad rap, I'm like, people are just replacing inexperience with millennials. And they're, you know, they're using it as a synonym, whereas it was no different 10 years, 20 years, 30 years ago. But to me, life is kind of like this thing around creating experiences. And then with each one of those, you're learning and your gut and instinct is getting better and better. And leadership, I think, comes down to just good instinct. And it's like, yes or no, yes or no, yes or no. But it's a lot of these experiences that have allowed me to, I think, have the confidence that this is it. We're going all in, and it's one thing saying, it's another thing doing. Walk the talk, and here we go. And that is, I think we live in a society, especially with social media and these different things, that coming up with novel thoughts or ideas is an anomaly, and it's risky. And I mean, most of my book is that. It's a lot of my own thoughts and philosophies and theories based on data. But it's scary. It's very scary. But
so now Sneaky Sunday, you do it. It fails, like you say. What's kind of the next? And I'll kind of ask two questions here. What's the next thing that you go to? But are you looking at Sneaky Sunday as a failure? Or is it something that was a lesson that you're appreciative of receiving?
Oh, 100% appreciative. I mean, I learned cap tables and the startup world and what risk really feels like. And it was right around that time that my wife and I were pregnant with our first child. And, you know, that'll catalyze things pretty quickly. And I reached out to a buddy of mine. We were on a panel together. David Rollo, who's, you know, now become one of my best friends, but I reached out to him and I was like, dude, I think it's time that I start finding a job. And he was like, oh, well, you should come over to 22 Squared. At the time, he was heading up media at 22 or digital media at 22 Squared. And so I met with them, and it was so refreshing to be at a full service agency because you could actually affect a lot more than just the digital stuff. So that's what kind of initially brought me there. And they didn't really know what to do with me. I mean, they were like, here's this social digital trend spotting guy. And I tell people that, you know, I spent the first 4 months kind of working for Collective Soul and helping them with their stuff and just running around trying to prove myself at 22, and people didn't really know what to do with me. And then I started building out the social media practice there, which ended up growing and obviously kind of taking off.
Yeah. So your time at 22, which you still work with, how did you grew into multiple positions?
Yeah.
So you started at one position, and it seems like 4 or 5 different positions till you ended up to the place that you're in now. How was that evolution? How did you kind of navigate through that? Was that you, once again, intentionally focusing on an end goal? Was it organic? How did that kind of evolve?
I just started doing... this sounds... One of the best pieces of advice that I got from both Brandon and Richard at 22 Squared, two of the executives there, was... the best way to get the job you want is to start doing the job you want.
And I love
so
that.
I've always kind of done that, where it's, I just will start doing the things. And then by the time that you ask for the job, it's like, yeah, well, you're already doing that anyways. And I think it's so much in our society, people love to say, this is what I'm going to do, or this is my Pinterest board with all the places I'm going to go. And no one takes action on it. And I think, once again, actions speak so much louder than words. And that's one piece, and I think has been critical to my own success in, all right, start doing it now.
I mean, I think that, personally, I love that advice. And now that you kind of say it, I'm also going to kind of put it into the universe and kind of implement some of that. Because I think it, you know, I think it kind of ties into why you are so connected to millennials, probably, and why you are the millennial whisperer, is for the sense that a lot of these young kids, people don't understand, but they're doing what you just said. They're going out and doing it. They're creating their own YouTube channels. They're doing their own viral videos. They're just going for it. Now, I'm not saying every single one of them are like that, mm-hmm. but I think that they're willing to take risks, or what older generations may have seen as risks, and making it the new norm.
Totally.
So let's kind of jump in there. So from 22... you know, you kind of build out that department, you move into the digital role, into the EVP role. Now your crazy ideas and ventures, people are now supportive of and saying, wow, this is really unbelievable. And you're overseeing a team. And what are you currently doing with that team that you oversee?
So, you know, it was always my intention from the get-go of building out the social media practice to disintegrate it into the agency. And one of my big things is like, what is social is digital? What is digital is social? What is social is like life, right? So if we're doing a good job, then we won't exist by the time we're done. And so we did that. And it was around that disintegration that I then went on to my place within business development and just networking. And I was head of business development for about 2 years, where I would just network. And which comes very naturally, because I love people so much. But it's also where I kind of hit and identify and start my book this way, my own rock bottom, with just, I got burned out and I had lost sight of what was so important to me. And I'd spent so much time being the point of the arrow and almost, you know, the Don Draper out there selling us. And what I refocused on, and the big change for me, was looking at my metric of success, which was beating my brothers in the game of life. Once again, talking about my past, and I changed that to success is going to be judged on a daily basis, and it's going to be amount of energy put into the day and then impact made. And we're going to decide that when my head hits the pillow whether or not that was a successful day. And that was 2.5 years ago, and I've had a successful day every single day since. But so that was a huge, huge, you know, evolution, but then also change within myself.
So how did you, because in this day and age, I feel more than ever, health and wellness is a big topic, right? Especially on the mental side. A lot of people, you know, they get discouraged. They're going through things. Some people stay in positions just because it's easy and it's comfortable, or they're just really unhappy, right? They may have money. They may have success, but they're defining success differently now. It's not financial. It's like you said, is each day winning for me? Each day am I passionate, happy, and going about it? What allowed you that freedom or gave you that kind of that courage to say, okay, I'm doing a great job at biz dev, but this isn't what I want to do, and I'm going to make that change? How were you able to kind of navigate that? Was it easy, or what were you doing to kind of mentally prep yourself to say, I'm willing to give up all of this because this is not bettering me and my soul?
Yeah, I mean, it was absolute rock bottom. It was hitting absolute rock bottom. And also, one, I mean, for me, what rock bottom is probably most people's middle, or so I was told by the doctors that I went to go talk to about it all. But, you know, I think one of my big things now is, like, why do we have to hit rock bottom in order to see change in our lives? And what I'm trying to provide for those around me and create a movement around is, let's create an environment where we can actually seek change within ourselves, but also this need for connection. And I talk a lot about this with people, but, you know, our instinct as human beings when we're going and hitting our own rock bottom is to go sit in the corner and journal by ourselves in a coffee house or in a bar. And whereas what we need the most is connection with others and real connection. And, you know, once again, also, I think deep down as human beings, all we want is to be loved. And I mean, you can put that as probably, you can dissect any part of my life and you'll see that kind of rise to the top. So, my rock bottom, I discovered this within myself and I thought to myself, okay, one, I need to change my metric of success, but two, I got to go give back to the world. And I'm going to be a coach. I'm going to be a servant leader, and I'm going to see how I can actually impact lives from the inside out. And so that's what I did.
And is this when kind of the idea for the book and the movement kind of comes to mind?
So it was actually a year after taking on that position and overseeing a group of millennials, and, you know, the content marketing and influencer marketing departments within 22 Squared. But it was about a year after that that you were invited, actually, on this men's executive retreat.
I do remember.
Right?
I do remember. I couldn't attend, so yeah. I just want to put that out there. My apologies.
But, you know, our friend...
I may have written a book if I did.
Totally. But, you know, our friend Bert and Tommy and people that have been on this podcast before were there. And I didn't really know a lot of the other guys on this retreat, but I went to introduce myself on the Friday night around the fire. And I said, you know, like, I don't really know what I do at my agency, but I'm kind of like the millennial whisperer. And I then shared my own story of hitting rock bottom and all the things. And, you know, I think I was like wiping some tears away. And I sat down and Tommy, who I didn't know at the time, kicks me by the fire. And he goes, you better write that book. And I was like, what, my story about my journey? He was like, no, the millennial whisperer. And then people started, were like, so Chris, tell us, what are some of the things that you do? Because I can't stand these kids. And then, you know, I would say the average age was mid-40s and of the people around the fire at this retreat. And so I would share some of these tactics and things. And they're like, holy shit. Like, you do that stuff? I'm like, yeah. And that was when I was like, okay, I think I might have a book here. And that was 14 months ago. So now fast forward, we're 5 weeks after publishing.
Yeah.
And we're a bestseller and that's starting to take off.
So for those that haven't read the book yet or not familiar with The Millennial Whisper, like you said, just came out this February,
yep.
Already bestseller, getting an unbelievable review from a number of different publications, media outlets, you know, super well received because I think there's a void in the marketplace for this kind of like almost guide or Bible in a sense to
yep.
This kind of generation. Tell people a little bit about what The Millennial Whisper is, what the goal of it was, the book, and then we'll kind of talk a little bit more in depth on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the goal of the book is to bring more love and empathy slash connection into where we spend 9 hours a day. And I think our corporations and a lot of the lives that we live haven't caught up to the world that we are surrounded by, whether that be the influence of social media and our own anxieties that are created around it. And you know, the fact that I bring up stuff like my 70-30 rule, where 30% of life is hard. 30% of your job is going to suck. 70% should fuel you up and get you excited. But just getting to that understanding in this world of Instagram and comparing our insides to other people's outsides, it's we suffer from the grass is always greener complex. So it's going through some of those things, but then also tactically, what are the things that we can put into place within our organizations to not only alleviate anxieties in the workplace and some of these things, but also how do we better attract and retain the next generation of talent? How do we instill better connection within our teams? And you know, it's like we've been brought up in this way, and like corporations, the boss has to be the boss and you can't be friends with your employees. Screw that. And I think you got to be real. Like, people just want to be real. People will ask, like, so Chris, the top three things that millennials want statistically from the Deloitte Millennial Survey are transparency, inspirational leadership, and autonomy. And they're like, well, let's talk to me about that. And it's like, okay, well, transparency is an easy one because people think transparency is either crying in front of your employees or showing them all your financials. And it's like, no, just be real.
Yeah.
Just talk about life. Talk about, I've got an idea. How about starting your town hall meeting about the one mistake you made last week and how you're learning from it? So that, I mean, I get really excited about this.
No, I mean, I think, you know, you make a valid point, especially in this day and age of company and how corporate typically works. I mean, you're even seeing it now where dress codes are shifting from what they used to be and companies are loosening up. But I tell our team all the time, I mean, this is your family. You're with these people more than your loved ones.
Yeah.
So if you're not creating an environment where it's welcoming, transparent, encouragement, supportive, I think you're going to have very unhappy people.
Totally.
So then that kind of leads into this whole misconception of everybody has this stigma that millennials are entitled, they're selfish, they're lazy, all these different things. You think completely opposite. You're bringing a new perspective and a new outlook to it. And kind of what is your outlook on millennials versus what the standard corporate individual might think in this day and age?
So one of my favorite quotes around the book itself is millennials aren't the problem, they just expose the problem. My friend Evan LaPointe brought that up when I was meeting him for coffee. I was like, yep, there it is. Or when I met Mike Hibison, who's an executive at Home Depot, and one of the stories in my book, he turned to me, he goes, and he kind of whispered as he was meeting me for breakfast, he goes, Chris, I'm kind of like a millennial. You know what I'm figuring out after reading your book is millennials much more of a mindset than anything else. Like, exactly. And so if you look at all those misconceptions, some are true, you know, like needy. I think we're all a lot needier, you know, and I think we live in a world where we have instant validation, instant gratification, and instant everything. And the harsh reality is real success, true happiness, all of those great things in life come with hard work, and it comes with walking the talk. And you know, we talked, I think, earlier about how it's interesting how millennials, just people will use it as a synonym for inexperienced, and in reality it's like, listen, like there's a little bit of millennial in all of us. But it's what we're experiencing, I think, as a society, is that we're just catching up to some of the massive changes that have happened, whether it be with mobile devices and social media and these other things that have basically changed our workplaces.
So do you think of it as the folks in the non-millennials, the X's, the Y's, the baby boomers, are we the ones that are behind and missing this opportunity, and the millennials are the ones that have this shit together?
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I think there's still a lot to be said with experience, right? For experience. And I'm an Xer, I'm born in 1980, but I'm on the cusp. But I think it's more of the things that they're identifying that are wrong with our corporations are the things that we have got to start addressing now.
So one big one's culture, right? You always hear people, company culture, this is what millennials want. But even outside of millennials, I think culture in general is super important. What do you define as culture when it comes to millennials? What does that culture need to be that they're walking away from that job every day, not calling it a job, looking at it as something that they're passionate about, that's rewarding for them, that they love going to day in, day out?
Yeah, culture is a byproduct of good leadership. That's it.
Love that line, actually.
You know, I think I just made it up.
You need to write that down.
Yeah, I probably should. But it is. And I think people look to... I say it on the back of my book, which is throw away the beer kegs and ping pong tables. And because that is a quick fix. That's our society saying, oh, yeah, we've got a culture problem. I use a woman named Angela in the book, and she brought me aside. Her name's not really Angela, but she brought me aside and said, Chris, I just don't get it. I don't get it. You know, I've got a barista, a full-time barista. I've got a cereal bar where we have 35 different cereals for people to choose. And people are still quitting. Like, we still have a turnover rate of over 30% every year. And I then started talking to her. I was like, well, you know, the issues are much deeper, right? And look at the statistics. And I think one thing, I worked with one of my favorite Vanderbilt professors on the statistical side of this thing, but what millennials are looking for out of the workplace hasn't changed. You know, there's still the number one thing, they want money and they want benefits. So there's some variation with the generations with like work flexibility is a huge one.
Yeah.
And
I find that one of the biggest ones, which you kind of have to evolve a little bit, yep, because now being mobile, I mean, as long as you're getting trustworthy people, look, you could have somebody sitting at a desk in your office. It doesn't mean they're delivering or executing.
Totally.
You know?
Totally. And I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, technology's changed everything, right? And so where I like to focus is more on leadership. So what do they want? They want inspirational leadership. They want autonomy and they want transparency. And I will tell that time and time and time again. And some of those things are difficult to put your kind of finger on, especially inspirational leadership, because I tell this story a lot where if you ask Bob, who's the leader of their group, and you're just like, Bob, hey, you know, kids these days, they want inspirational leadership. Bob, are you inspirational? Bob will say, hell yeah, I'm inspirational. Do you see them light up? You know, anytime I talk to them. And then you ask two people on Bob's team and they're like, oh my God, Bob is like the least inspirational person ever. And so that's also why I created this tool, the Millennial Leadership Assessment, which is 360 by design, where it's asking your actual employees, how do you rank on some of these things that are important to being a leader in today's day and age? Inspiration being one of those. I babble on this stuff, but I think, you know, the other thing about culture is that not only is it the byproduct of good leadership, I'm going to use that line again, but there needs to be this empowerment and letting go of the culture. And I think Richard Ward at 22 Squared, our CEO, did a great job of giving a foundation where he came up with kind of the pillars of what our culture, he saw it to be, whether it be, the embracing change being one of those, or everyone is a leader. And those are two of the culture pillars. But then he let the rest of the employees really define what the culture could be. And people ask, so what is 22's culture? I've heard a lot about your culture. And it's like, actually, the best way to define it is go to hashtag 22 culture. And there are over 4,000 posts on Instagram that is all about everything from, you know, get-togethers and hanging out to crazy stuff, right? And so that, to me, I think that idea of letting go and letting your employees mold the culture itself is a huge piece. And I mean, I think empowerment is something that you'll hear. That's the autonomy thing. People don't want to be babysat. They don't want to be told what our culture is. Let us help define it. And I bring up this idea in the book about, like, you know, true empowerment is not only letting go, but letting them really, there's this concept of protect this house and pushing down that almost, that responsibility is so critical for them to protect this house as it relates to bad culture fits. Let them spit out the bad culture fit.
Yeah.
You know, or whether it be some of these other big issues of, you know, unlimited vacation time. Let them police that. Because when one person leaves for a month and then comes back, guess what that person that was covering for them will do? Yeah. They'll go and leave for a month. And it ends up taking care of itself.
So, you know, a lot of good notes and kind of things, especially for corporations as far as what you need to do to retain employees on the millennial side. But what can companies do to attract millennials? Because that's the biggest thing is, right, we're all competing for certain talent, especially in the agency space. You know, I want a great AE, I want a great videographer, I want a great designer. What can companies do to attract these kids and then get them at least in the door to say, I want to be here? Kind of like when you took your first job at Moxie, right? There was something there that energy-wise you said, this is for me.
Yep.
What can companies do to do that for people to where kids are going in or millennials and saying, this is right. I like this. This is the culture I want to be involved with.
Well, I mean, I think they need to see that it's a place where people are smiling and having fun. I mean, come on, like what happened to having fun at work? And so you can get that as soon as you walk into an even work environment, whether or not it's, and I guess that's what they say is culture, right? But I think some of the other things that we have to start visiting more is, what do you represent? What is your purpose? Purpose is massive in today's day and age. And, you know, how are we actually giving back to the world around us, I think, is another important thing and a responsibility that corporations have got to start tackling, big and small. And I think it's camaraderie. It's, you know, supporting each other. It's a lot of these things that kind of go back down to my two core tenets, which is this connection piece and this need for kind of love and empathy. And the more that we can bring those into our corporations, I think the better we'll be.
So you talked about causes and things along those lines. It definitely seems like a lot of millennials these days are really passionate about causes, experiences, community, and all these different things. I mean, hence why you have the WeWorks of the world and all these things where people feel like they're part of a group.
Yeah.
You know, you see it with CrossFit or different sporting events even, right? People have this shared camaraderie. What, as far as kids are doing or millennials are going for, is there a perfect equation? Like, what is the ideal situation to say, this is, if you could build the perfect environment with the pillars as you discussed,
yeah,
if you could only pick three right now, what would be the three that you're like, these are, we need to live and die by?
I mean, I think purpose is massive.
Okay.
So defining your corporation's purpose, but also allowing a development program where people can identify their own individual purposes. And I think we will wait for that for whatever reason in our lives to put our own purpose. Mine, it was great. You know, we have an executive coach at 22, and 4 years ago, 5 years ago, she forced me to create my own purpose, which has not changed, which is to inspire and connect. And, you know, so I think purpose is a key one. I think autonomy and laissez-faire to a certain degree approach is huge. And then I think that this, you know, I'd say culture is probably the third one that needs to come along. But, you know, I go back to my own ways of what's kept me at my current job for 10 years now, actually, that, like, maybe this week, 10 years. And I go back to a conversation I had with my wife coming back from a holiday party. And she goes, Chris, how have you lasted this long? And this was, you know, after just 5 years at the company. And I was like, you know what? I know what it is. And it's, they've given me enough of a leash that I can, you know, a long enough leash that I can be entrepreneurial, but they've given me enough structure that I'm always becoming a better leader. And I think that is the essence of what we're all looking for, isn't it? And I'm more of a millennial than most millennials, you know, like, and that's true. One of the things I'm trying to overcome with the book itself is some of those, that, all that stuff.
So the book, obviously, a lot of great information in there for corporations as kind of a blueprint for the millennial culture and how to better suit their organization to be fitting of it. However, from the millennial side, how do you view the book being for them? Is it a tool and a resource for them to utilize as well to see how they're being perceived and what they can do better on their end?
So thanks for the trademark lawyer. She's been awesome. But she explained to me, I use Justin's trademark lawyer for the trademark, the Millennial Whisperer, but in order for it to be trademarked for a book, it has to be a series. So my second book will be directed towards millennials. I was very careful to have this be a leader of, be a book by leaders for leaders. And it's also where my editor, Nick Pavlidis, came in, and he would always check me and be like, listen, you're writing this for boomers and Xers. And, but one of the byproducts of it has been millennials. I was looking on Twitter the other day and someone said, I quit my job a week ago and just sent my boss the book, The Millennial Whisperer, to teach him a little bit about why, about the things that he needs to do to keep people like me.
That's amazing.
And so, and then also in audiences, as I've been speaking in front of more audiences, there are always people afterwards that, you know, millennials, younger millennials especially, will come up and just say, thank you, Chris. Thank you for helping try to change our organization. So that's been somewhat of a surprise. But I want to be very upfront and deliberate about the fact that this book is written for Xers and boomers. And I hired an editor to help me with that, which was probably my greatest struggle.
Yeah, it's probably hard to separate the two.
It is. And, you know, my tendency is to write for millennials, because I'm deep down more of a millennial than a lot of them. So having that was pretty critical.
So I'll wait to come back and ask you this question when the new book comes out so that I can ask it. But for this current book, if there's one takeaway for a corporate leader to take from this book, what would be the one thing? If you're going to walk away with one piece of knowledge, I read this book, you know, I only retain one thing. What is the one thing they need to know?
I mean, the one thing I think is that is just we can change our organization starting today. And there's a lot of different statistics and foundations that the book is built upon and the way that I set it up. But I mean, it comes down to really 8 different chapters, which I laid it out. And what are the things that we can implement today that cost almost nothing to really change our culture and change the way that our organizations are being led and perceived within this environment. So I can't just say this is the one thing, because that's why I wrote a whole book about it. But it's very tactical in the way that I wrote it.
But I think the good takeaway from that is that, especially me having an agency, being a leader, let's say, where I work for my people, as I tell them.
Yeah.
The number one thing I would say is, I don't have the time to implement this, or I'm too busy, or it's too big of an overhaul. Mm-hmm. I think what's amazing with the book that you've written is that, just what you said, this isn't something where you have to shake it up and it's going to take months to implement, years to implement, new programming and processes. It's a mindset.
Yeah, it's 100%. And, you know, I'll go back and I finish a lot of my, you know, rewards and recognition is one of those like kind of key tenants. And so an example of one of the tactics that I talk about is a ridiculous example is this company out in San Francisco called Domo. And Domo, on your first day at Domo, you write down your at bat song. So what song do you want blaring on the loudspeakers when you go up to bat? And then you will hear on the first day of every month someone's at-bat songs blaring on the loudspeakers, and then these blue sirens go off, and then they drag a 10-foot blue rooster over to that person, salesperson's desk, and it sits there for the whole month until there's a new salesperson of the month. And everyone is clamoring for that reward. That's it. That, like, there's no financial thing. It's everyone wants this blue rooster and their at-bat song. And okay, so that's a little extreme, but so what I do in all of our team statuses is I do what's called snaps, where we will give each other snaps, and I'll say, I just want to give snaps to Meg. She killed it yesterday in the new business pitch, or she went above and beyond, or, you know, she just helped me out when I was feeling low. And then everyone does snaps. And we do that for like 25 minutes. And so it's a way of actually covering a lot of the bases in terms of what everyone's working on. And well, a lot better than going through an Excel document. Yeah. So that's one. People are like, well, give me an example. And I give them those examples. And then they look at me like I'm crazy, because they're like, you do that? You actually do that? And I'm like, well, if you have that response, then we got to work on some other stuff first.
But you have the, you know what? You're giving people what you said, which is the acknowledgement. A little snap is more than just a snap. It's people feel good. They feel loved. You know, they feel like they're being recognized, like you say. So if you had an at-bat song, what would be your song?
Oh, my gosh. So I kid, like all we do is win. But that's so obnoxious. It actually wouldn't be. It would most likely be probably something from a musical. And for whatever reason, I end up singing Rent. And so La Vie Boheme is by far, I don't know if that's like the best at bat song. But right now I'm also obsessed with Pine Grove's new album that just came out. And it would probably, I mean, it's like the worst at bat song, but like that's probably what, I mean, that's on constant rotation and probably what best defines me right now.
Okay. We'll go with that. Yeah. We'll go with that.
Yeah.
All right, cool. So for those that want to get the book,
yeah,
where can they find it? Where can they order it? So on.
So we'll be, I don't know when this will air, but we'll be in every single bookstore, you know, pretty much now. We'll be in all the airports in June, every single airport. And it should be fairly easy to find Amazon, as well as you can download the first chapter at themillennialwhisper.com. I've learned millennials hard to spell, two L's, two N's, two L's, two N's for millennial. And you can download the first chapter as well as take stuff like the millennial leadership assessment as well as some other tools. But yeah, so it should be pretty easy to pick up.
So pretty much it's harder not to find it at this point.
We're getting there. We're getting there. We're getting there. I mean, definitely in Atlanta because I drop them everywhere. People will text me, be like, Chris, there are four copies of your book at Brash. I'm like, yeah, because I drop them off there every week.
Just start throwing them at houses.
Oh, totally.
I love it, dude.
We're not quite there yet.
You got to do, what is it, Halloween this year? Just drop it and all the kids be like, give that to your parents. They'll thank me.
Someone told me, one of the big authors said that one of the best problems you could ever have is giving away 10,000 books. And it just shows that if you can give away 10,000 books, it shows there's a big enough market for your book that there's probably a business behind it.
Crazy. So now, with that being said, what is next for you?
So right now, we're really focused on talking to some of the different corporations about how to implement and execute this book. But where I'm putting a lot of our effort is building the back-end digital training system of bringing the book to life. So pretty excited about what we have going there. And I think, you know, that should be implemented within the next few months.
Okay. Well, listen, man, appreciate you coming in today. I know you're a busy guy, traveling all over, media interviews. Somehow I got you to come in to fit this schedule.
Oh, no,
I'll tell you, it's been amazing. It's but the one thing I'll say is you always step up. This success never changes you. I love the drive. I love the energy and excited to see what you're going to do next. And whatever you're forecasting or trending, please let me know.
Yeah.
I can be on it.
Well, I sign all my books with kind of what's become my, I guess, sign off. But I think the best is yet to come. And, you know, I think what I'm trying to do with this book, my intentions are so pure. And I think that in life, we must choose light over dark. And I think that comes down to more connection and more love. And why not start at our corporations? And, you know, I think walking the talk is another thing that we don't see enough of. And so I think the best is yet to come, Justin.
Nice, man. Well, let me give gratitude and love back.
There you go.
I appreciate it, man. So thanks for coming in today, dude. Really appreciate it.
Awesome.
Congrats, man. Thanks. Once again, I'm your host, Justin Epstein, and thank you for listening to Culturation. As always, this show has been powered by Premiere.